I'm on the road to recovery, step by step.
Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group, Thursday night, Alcoholics and God Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Nathan. Thanks for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation, so please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that make noise that might distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away. And ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everyone ready? If so, let's start the meditation. Okay, now the fog light prayer. It's going to be on the left and the right, and then it's here on the sign too. God, let your love shine through us,
like a far light, so those who are lost and can die can find your love through us.
There is a solution from the Big Book, page 17. The tremendous fact for everyone is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is great news that this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Javier to read The Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is.
Javier, recovered alcoholic. Javier. Spiritual experience. The terms spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which, upon careful reading, shows that the personality change sufficient to bring about recovery from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change in feeling and outlook. Among our rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerance or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer.
Thank you, Javi. Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. This is a tech-free meeting, so set your phones to airplane mode or just turn them off. Now I introduce to you Allie B. She's on her first session, so please come up, Allie B. Thank you.
Thanks. Is this on? Oh, okay. All right, O'Malley, I'm an alcoholic. So what's going on up here? Are these on and this is on? Is that okay? Because I have a loud voice, so what's that? Just the ear thing, so then. Awesome. O'Malley, I'm an alcoholic, and it's a blessing to be with you guys here tonight. You know, I never know what's going to happen when I get up here and do these things. And truth is, everything I plan to say never really comes out anyway. And I'm just grateful to be alive and sober thanks to the Sacred Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and a program that truly saved my life. And when I say a program, I mean the 12 steps. You know, AA's 12 steps have practiced as a way of life, enable the sufferer, which is me. I'm the suffering one. I'm the chronic alcoholic. And they have enabled me to become happily and usefully whole. Nothing I say up here is original. I should probably preface that. And I'm not a spokesperson for Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm not a public speaker by any means. This is not my favorite thing to do. But I was taught that no matter what, when Alcoholics Anonymous asks me to do something, I say yes, and I show up today because I had a hard time doing that through my drinking career. So basically tonight, it's, you know, just your introduction to me. And I'm going to be here, you know, God willing, that, you know, he keeps me sober long enough for the series. And I'll be here, you know, for the next 3 months. So I just kind of wanted to let you guys get to know me a little bit. And we're on the first step, so it's not going to be anything too crazy, I hope. But the first step just says that I have to admit, I have to concede to my innermost self, and I have to be willing to sacrifice. And the whole deal is about sacrifice. All the 12 steps, you know, we have a handful of spiritual principles sprinkled throughout the steps. And they get repeated. They're repetitive over and over again. And sometimes we lean on humility a little bit more. And sometimes we're going to lean on honesty a little bit more. Sometimes we're going to lean on willingness a little bit more. But the first step is where we lean on surrender and letting go and sacrifice and honesty. And it took me a long time to get that. A long time to get that. You know, and in Bill's story in chapter one in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, he hits a series of three bodies. He does his first step three times. I relate to that. And that's just the ones that we know about. I mean, who knows what was actually going? This is just what gets published about the guy, right? But who knows what was really going on behind closed doors? Maybe we'd have to ask Lois that. I don't know. But for me, I had to be completely humbled and beaten into a state of reasonableness. My sobriety date is October 20th of 2009. And that took me 12 years to get that. And it's simply because of this first step, you know. In the Big Book in chapter 3, he says, most of us have been unwilling to admit that we were real alcoholics. We have to concede it to our innermost selves. That's a broad statement. Most of us is a lot of people. And why is that? Why is it so hard for somebody like me to get this first step? By the way, the only one I can practice with complete honesty, with complete perfection. Why is that so hard for me? You know, why does it take me 3 years of coming into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, being around people that are spiritually fit? I was around people that were armed with the facts, that were following guys like Joe and Charlie and were coming out of the Big Book of AA. And it was sacred, and they were willing to help me, and they were willing to show up for me, but I still couldn't surrender. I still couldn't get honest. Well, that's what the whole thing is all about. I have to find a power by which I can live. I am without power. I don't have the ability to remove this thing called the obsession of the mind. Right? So let me just back up a little bit. Before we get to chapter one, and I'm going to, you know, talk about the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous because it's my primary source. It's the source that leads to the source for me. And I found it to be perfectly written. I didn't think that at first, you know, when I was in rehab, and hopefully I'll get into that a little bit tonight. This meeting ends at what, 10 o'clock, right? but no, really, what time does it end? 8:30 or 8:15? Okay, 8:15. But yeah, when I was in rehab and I read the Big Book all by myself and thought, you know, self-knowledge, I was like Roland Hazard, and I didn't see a need for this cleaving to my sponsor or asking for help or coming to believe in the we part of the program, and I thought I could do it all by myself, and I didn't realize that I don't have the ability to remove the obsession to drink, right? So before I get to page one in the Big Book, in Bill's story, that we have this thing called the doctor's opinion, which is written by Dr. William D. Silkworth, who's a medical doctor at Towns Hospital, which is where Bill Wilson comes and he meets him. And this whole thing is divinely, you know, we put up these pictures of the history, which I very much love, and the whole thing is divinely inspired. The whole thing is divinely inspired. It's amazing to me that this program that came about in 1935, it's 2019, and it still works. 80 plus years later, and it's still working. And I didn't have to go to a doctor or a therapist, you know, or treatment. My sponsor came in, actually, she came in through Al-Anon because she didn't think she had a problem. She thought it was her husband that had the problem. But this is how God rescues us. You know, he knows how to get to us when we don't know what we need. He knows what we need. So just to back up, you know, in this doctor's opinion, we have this thing called the upset. You know, Dr. Silkworth gives us the definition of what an alcoholic is. And for the first time, I'm reading that with fresh eyes, and I'm a little dried out, and something hits me. And he tells us that men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. He says the sensation is so elusive that while I can admit that it's going to cause me some injury and I'm going to suffer some consequences, I cannot differentiate the difference. I can't bring into my mind. I can't differentiate. I can't tell the difference between the true and the false. The first definition of insanity that we're going to talk about next week with the second step. And that no matter what, I'm gonna try to recapture the days of the good old, I'm gonna try to recapture this feeling of the good old days and this desperate attempt of that first drink when the booze hits my system, it's gonna be repeated over and over again. And then he says, unless I can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope for my recovery. You know, and why is it that I keep repeating the desperate experiment of the first drink? Well, Dr. Silkworth tells us. He says, I have this thing called the obsession of the mind. And it, for me, it goes something like this, you know, just to give you a little bit of, you know, the highlight reel before I crawled through the doors of AA. I'm the only alcoholic in my family. And between the ages of kindergarten and my senior year of high school, I switched schools. I was taken out of my home life, and I switched schools 17 times in 12 years. And I started in California, and then I went to New Jersey, and then I went up to Vermont, and then to Philadelphia, and New York City was in there a little bit. My whole family is from New York, so I spent a lot of, you know, my childhood going into the city, and down to Tennessee, and then back to New Jersey. And I don't know, and I'll talk about this more on step four, that somehow I was internalizing all of that and blaming myself for why we kept moving. And, you know, for a long time, I thought that there was something wrong with me. See, I was always the new girl, and I would show up to school. And Bill talks about faulty dependencies and how I'm going to try to dominate people or I'm going to demand more of them than I can get. And I start acquiring people as if they're hostages to fill this void when I'm 9 years old. And my father leaves when I'm 9 years old, and I never hear from him again. And I never really had a relationship with him to begin with. He was diagnosed bipolar, among other things. Not an alcoholic. You know, I'm the only one diagnosed. You know, and the way that I dealt with that is it just, I don't have a dad. You know, people would ask me in school, what about your dad? Well, I don't have one of those. You know, and that's just how that I had to preserve, self-preservation. I had to get through it. And so he leaves when I'm 9, and I feel completely abandoned, but my ego, which, you know, the ego for somebody like me is completely, you know, blown up and distorted. The alcoholic ego, you know, what I have, is to a different extent than what exists in a normal person. That's what we learn in the literature. We learn it from Dr. Jung, too. And my ego reconstructs itself right there, and I start forming all of these abandonment issues. And I start getting into fights on the playground. I develop a very bad temper because I'm going to hurt you before you hurt me. And then I switch schools again. You know, so as soon as I start to, like, make a friend or a hostage, you know, whatever you want to call it, I go and I switch schools again. And then I'm the new girl all over again. And I become a tomboy. And I start suffering, you know, severe identity crisis. I'm, you know, wearing tie-dye and I'm listening to Wu-Tang Clan. And I have no idea who I am, but I'm proclaiming that I'm, like, an artist and I'm ahead of my time. And now I'm in high school. And Bill talks about that we have these, the resting state, the natural resting state of every alcoholic, this is in the doctor's opinion, again in the Roman numerals, is that I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. That is who I am without God. And that's why I need alcohol, to get the sense of ease and comfort. That's the only thing that's going to fix that for me. And that internal condition, because that's what this deal is for me, that internal condition starts, you know, I think it started when I'm 4 and 5 years old, but I know it gets capitalized when I'm 9 and the dad leaves, and now I'm all alone and I feel abandoned. And I need something to fix that. I don't have a solution for that. And I'm showing up and I'm 12 years old and I think I'm in 6th grade and now I'm in a private school. And I'm smart and they're telling me that I'm smart. And that's feeding that ego. And that becomes, oh, I'll just latch onto that. I'll just get good grades and that'll be who I am and that'll be my identity because the ego needs something to cling on to. I don't yet have a dependence on God. I have to depend on something else. You guys have to tell me who I am. The teacher had to tell me who I was. So they say things to me like, congratulations on your test. You got an A. And I'm 12 years old, and what I hear is, you're the most brilliant genius in the whole entire world. You should be writing books. You could be teaching this class. And I get, you know, that gets co-signed by my family and by the few people that were, you know, crazy enough to be in my life at that time. And they, you know, they start feeding this illness that I have. And this just goes on and on. And by the time I'm 14, I finally take that first drink. And I just remember, you know, I think it was, I'm a blackout drunk. I'm a chronic alcoholic. I'm the real deal. I'm what the book calls dangerously antisocial. That was me. You know, the mentally unstable types. That's me. You know, I was all those types. Manic depressive, about which a whole chapter could be written. Yes, absolutely. I was, you know, diagnosed that too. Great. Welcome. And I just remember taking that first drink, and the restlessness and the irritability and the discontentedness just went bye-bye. And for the first time, I felt like I could breathe. And when I'm sitting down with a newcomer or even somebody who has time and we're going through Bill's story, this is when I share my drunkalog, not from the podium. I mean, I'm going to talk about it tonight because we're on step one, but hopefully not too much. Because I don't want to stay in the problem. And Bill writes the big book in problem-solution format. He was a law student. That's a type of writing that lawyers get taught. And that's how he writes it. It's symbolic. It's a metaphor. I can either be living in the problem or living in the solution. I can be either in faith or I'm in fear. I'm either coming from self or I'm coming from God. You know, what is my choice to be? What is my choice to be? So anyway, I remember that feeling. Everything calms down for me. And that's what I continue to chase for the next 10-plus years. And it gets really bad. Alcoholism is a progressive disease. And at first, it wasn't that bad. You know, I was able to just drink on the weekends, and I had a fake ID. And then something happens. You know, I have this chemical imbalance as an alcoholic, and I start hearing voices, and I start getting really crazy when I drink. You know, now I'm turning into the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that the big book talks about. And I start acting out when I'm drunk, and I black out, and I get violent when I drink. And nobody can be around me. And I'm going into bars at the age of 16 and 17 years old, and I'm getting flagged from the bars. And I'm picking up boyfriends left and right, you know, whatever you want to call them, guys, whatever, boys. And I'm slashing their tires when I think they're cheating on me. And the cops are getting called on me. And this is what a normal drinker does, you know. And what makes me so sick and need God so much, lack of power is my dilemma. We learned that on page 45. And what makes me so sick is despite all of this evidence, I still come down here in Boca Raton, Florida, where I go to my halfway house at Awakenings, little plug, and I still think I can control it. Chapter 3, I still think it'll be different this time, right? And no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we're going to see how our experience can benefit others. I went pretty far down the scale. You know, this is just when I'm 16 years old. And I wind up in psych wards, you know, somebody like me, they don't know what to do with me. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I'm not willing to admit that there's anything wrong with me. I think it's you. I think it's the world. I attach myself to Edgar Allan Poe and Sigmund Freud, who was doing a substance that I like to do very much. And I start saying, you know, I align myself with these guys. Bill calls it his intellectual heroes. I relate to that. You know, the alcoholic ego, this masquerade. I'm way better than you. You know, my head will tell me things. It'll tell me that I'm either way better than you or I'm way worse than you. I'm never just one of you. I'm never just right-sized. I don't know how to get, you know, from there to here. And that's why I have to continue to try to dominate you. I have to run the show. I have to play a part, whatever you guys need me to be, because I don't have enough of myself yet. I don't know who I am. And my ego tells me I know exactly who I am. You know, wearing the tie-dyes and listening to Wu-Tang and, oh my gosh, Biggie got shot and Tupac got shot and I got to go to school and rep that. So I go to high school. I'm wearing the tie-dye still, you know, because I'm different. I'm terminally unique. You know, I'm an artist and I'm ahead of my time. And this is what the ego will tell me. It's all a lie. It's not who I really am. And I go to high school and I'm done with the private school now. And I'm out of psych ward number one, I think. And I'm wearing that like a badge of honor. You know, I was taught always be different, always be unique, you know, be a trendsetter. And I'm thinking, okay, I went to a psych ward. I have a diagnosis now. Like, that's different. Now I technically can't ever be normal. Like, now I'm always going to be one of the abnormal ones. And, you know, maybe that's who I'm supposed to be now. And the alcohol gets really bad for me. You know, I start drinking round the clock. And Bill says it best, you know, he says that he comes to one day and quicksand stretches around him in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol is my master. It's his first step. It's when he realizes how hopeless he is. And I had a series of those bottoms out there. I really did. And it gets really bad for somebody like me. And I go, and I'm in and out of psych wards. And, you know, I remember at one point they had brought me to a detox. And my aunt, who married my uncle, she wasn't my blood aunt. I say that to say this, you know, she wasn't as, it wasn't as easy to fool her because she hadn't grown up with me. She was like a newcomer to the family, you know, so she saw through my crap. And she was like, I think you have a problem with alcohol. And I was like, no, I don't. And this was after I was overdosing and I was stealing from my family and I was punching holes in the walls and I was stealing my grandmother's car. I think I'm around 17 or 18 years old at this point. And she says, you know, there's this detox, and this is all happening in South Jersey. There's this detox out in Atlantic City in a really bad area, actually. And I didn't have any money. I didn't have money. Any money I had went towards alcohol. I was working. I mean, I was waitressing and stuff. But so she sends me off to this detox. And my mom, I remember, like, didn't believe it. She's like, Allie, you know, she's not an alcoholic. She's just bipolar with other things. You know, I had other things that I was bipolar plus. You know, I had bipolar, and then I had manic tendencies and homicidal tendencies, and I was BPD and OCD and, you know, OPP, whatever. They were giving me all these different labels. And it was never alcoholic. You know, that was never the thing until the aunt comes in, and she's like, yeah, you know, I've seen alcoholics before. I think she's got a problem with alcohol. So off I go to the detox. And it's a 3-day program, and my alcohol level was so intense, and I'm sure, you know, if you're in this room, you could probably relate to this, that we have an allergy to alcohol. So when I succumb to the desire, so many do, and I succumb to this irrational thought, this obsession of the mind, I put it in my body. My body sets up a demand for more of it. Thereby, I digest it differently. So I'm able to walk around, and I should be dead. And doctors are saying things like, you should be dead right now with how high your blood alcohol level is. And how is it that you're reciting poetry, you know, standing on top of the filing cabinet in the hospital? And you should be dead. And that was a true story. I really did stuff like that in my blackouts. You know, again, I think I'm Edgar Allan Poe. So that's the deal for me, though, is that I have this different reaction. I have a chemical reaction in my body when it separates me from the normal drinker, you know. And then I have this spiritual malady, which we're going to talk about later on. And so I go into the detox, and my blood alcohol level is so high that they've got to give me, not Xanax, like Librium to get me down off the booze, because otherwise I was going to have seizures. And I still don't think there's anything wrong. And the way it was for me back then is I always acquired people, you know, especially guys. And I found somebody that was going to buy my crap, that was going to make me feel good about myself. So I meet this guy, and he was Spanish, and I don't remember his name, but I always call him Jose because, you know, I don't remember. And I just remember, like, you know, he was awesome. Like, we met and we fell in love in this detox. And as soon as I stopped shaking and he stopped shaking and we went to group together and we were going to get married, we fell in love. And then right away we come up with this. I was like, how much time you got left in here? Well, I have 42 hours. How much time you got? I was like, 43. Perfect. So we make a plan that we're going to, of course, I'm not ready to get sober yet. So we make a plan that we're going to get out and we're going to panhandle, cause we don't have any money, on the boardwalk of Atlantic City and get money to go drink. Not think, you know, my alcoholic life seems the only normal one, and I'm only hurting myself. And so I just remember, you know, sitting in group one day, and I start thinning out a little bit, and I start coming out of the fog, and I realize, you know, this guy's got a great body, he's got great forearms, no teeth in his mouth. But I hadn't noticed that before, and for me, that didn't really matter, because I didn't really have standards back then, you know. So I was like, just don't smile, we'll be okay. And that's how I was. And so we get out and we get out of the detox. And all I remember, this is kind of before cell phones were like a thing. And I just remember my mother was on the corner in a really bad area in Atlantic City, sitting in her car waiting for me. And this, you know, she watched me kill myself for a long time. I was living in my grandmother's basement. She was living upstairs. And she watched me go into blackouts and fly into rages. She used to have to call the cops on me because I'd be overdosing. And she was scared that I was going to die. And here she is thinking I'm finally well. And she's sitting on the corner for me. And I see her car, and it's wintertime. And the thing was coming out of the tailpipe. And I'm with Jose, whatever. It's a blackout drunk, very fuzzy. And I don't even think, it's not even, you know, maybe I should go to my mom's car. I see her and we dip the other way because we had a plan to go drink. See, I'm without defense against the first drink. Even though I had been separated from it for 72 hours, thanks to chemical help, thanks to drugs and Librium, you know, I'm not ready to surrender yet. I'm not ready to admit it. You know, God's grace has not entered into the expel the obsession of drink, because I have to first admit that I'm powerless and I wasn't ready to do that. And everybody has their own journey with that, you know. Everybody does, and we don't get here a moment too soon. We get rescued right on time, perfect time in His time, so that we can help somebody else. And that's what was taught to me, and that's been my experience. So Jorge and I elope, and, you know, we go frolicking down the street. I think he had, like, a beat-up hoopty, and we go, and we go to the boardwalk, and we start panhandling, and you know, we bum money for change, and we go, and we get a bottle, and we drink it, and I black out. And I come to, and Jorge is gone, and it's the middle of the night, and it's wintertime, and I don't have anything except for my velvet trench coat and my boots, which were Uggs, so that, you know, they had the fur-lined boots, and I was, you know, very heavy boots that I had. And it's pouring outside. I mean, it's like a monsoon out, and I don't know where I am. And I come to, and Jorge's gone, and I don't have anything. And I open the door. I was in a motel room, like a crack motel, and, you know, bugs running around and stuff. And to me, my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. And I open the door, and it's monsooning outside, and I'm on the side of the Atlantic City Expressway with nowhere to go and no idea how I'm going to get home. And I, you know, I think my alcohol was wearing, but you know, like when you come to and you had drank so much the night before that you're still kind of a little wasted, but the restlessness is still back on you, like you're conscious of it and you need more. You know, I always had a certain level I had to be at. I could never just drink just a little bit. I had to be like completely wasted. And as soon as I start falling below that level, I need to drink even more just so that I can wrest satisfaction out of this life. And that's how I was. I was way below my level when I came to. So I go outside and I figure, you know what, I'm just going to have to start walking somewhere. And then I say to myself, you know, I really need a cigarette, you know, and I need to get some alcohol and I really need a cigarette because I smoked back then. And I go outside, step outside, and I see in the beacon, and I see in the distance, there's like a beacon of light and it's a big Shell station gas light sign. And I was like, oh, and back then, you know, I always had an idea of God. And to me, that was God. I was like, yeah, thank you, God, you know, Shell station. And I reach in my velvet trench coat pocket and I happen to have a $5 bill, which is exactly how much cigarettes were in Atlantic City, New Jersey back then. And again, I'm like, thank you, God. And I start, you know, trudging the road down the Atlantic City Expressway and my boots are sinking into the mud. And it's pouring out, and my velvet trench coat is getting heavier and heavier, and I come to a ravine. And the only thing for me to do, because the ravine was blocking me from getting to this gas station, is to go into the water. And so I let my boots sink into the mud, and I realize, oh my gosh, they're now getting caked over with mud, and there's the current is whipping up, and the winds are whipping up, and the rain is coming down, and the current is coming, and I realize I have to go under. I'm going to drown. And I'm full on swimming now, and I'm like, I can do this. I was on the swim team in high school, which, you know, I was drunk for that too, but whatever. And I'm just, oh, I'm going to be okay. And I realize I have to go under because I almost drown. And so I'm swimming and swimming, and I come out to the other side of that ravine, and I'm okay. And then I crawl into this gas station. And it's fluorescent lighting, and every, you know, I hated people back then. I really did. I had a real tremendous fear of people. And everybody's looking at me, and they're waving their noses at me, and they're giving me dirty looks. And I was like, wow, you know, I hate people. Like, what's wrong with these people? Like, how dare you stare at me like that? And yeah, you know, I can't stand people. And then I get up to the counter, and the guy's like looking at me, and he's looking at me like I'm crazy. And it's like, you know, got to be 4 a.m. or something. And I just remember my head was blaring at this point, and I needed alcohol so bad, but I really just wanted a cigarette so I could figure things out. And he's like, can I help you? And I was like, yeah, I'll take a pack of Newports, please. Like, what's the big deal? And so he, like, basically throws them at me and, like, you know, was, like, holding his nose. And I'm like, what a mean, rude guy this is, you know? So I leave there, and I learned later on that what I'd actually, in fact, swam through was the Atlantic City sewage system. So you could really say that my disease led me up Schitt's Creek without a paddle. I'm sorry for cursing, but it just has more of an impact when I curse. It's not like we're a stranger to cursing in here. So yeah, I mean, and to me, my alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So I have this obsession of the mind. I have an allergy of the body. Once I put it in me, I can't stop. And there seems to be no way of entirely getting rid of this without his aid. I don't cure myself of the obsession of the mind. My mind is where the problem is. And this continues for me. Things get really bad for me. My family says to me, if you come in the house anymore with that vodka on you, because I was drinking pop-off vodka, warm, out of the bottle, you know, no ice, no milk. Yeah, absolutely. Pop-off all the way. You know, the Russian vodka, but the cheap stuff. It was good. And it did the job. And then, you know, I want to tell myself, oh, I only drank wine when it was, you know, hoity-toity with the artist. No, that was never true. Anyway, so yeah, that's how I drank. And I just remember, you know, for years after that, the consequences just keep piling up. You know, they just keep going. And it never crosses my mind that maybe I should stop or try to moderate. You know, that never comes into my consciousness because booze is my only solution. I am so desperate for you to love me. I am so desperate to feel okay. I don't want to kill myself, but they have me on suicide watch because if you're drinking anything like me, it looks like I'm trying to kill myself. You know, and they keep putting me in psych wards. They don't know what to do with me. And I go in this one psych ward called Maryville, which is in New Jersey. And it's a state-run psychiatric because the way the psych system works in New Jersey is after you go to county so many times, then you get to go to state because they're like, you know, you've been to county 4 times and we've got you on all the drugs and everything. It doesn't seem to really be helping. So now you get to go to the state psych ward. Congratulations, you know. And so I go to this place called Ancora. And they had owned four beds of this state-run rehab called Maryville in New Jersey. And I didn't have any money, and my family had completely cut me off. And, you know, at this point, I didn't have an address because my mother, she would frisk me when I would come home from a night of drinking. And if I had alcohol anywhere, you know, hidden in my ski, I used to hide bottles in my ski jacket. I always had to get a ski jacket with pockets on the inside so I could hide my stuff everywhere, like a good alcoholic. And she would frisk me, and she would say, if you have alcohol, you can't come in this house. So I said, fine, I just won't come home. That's an easy one for somebody like me. Right? My alcoholic life seems the only normal one. So I go and I opt out of living in a house and I choose to live under the boardwalk with another guy that I fell in love with who was homeless and made it sound so great. You know, he said, this is going to be our new palace. And I love the beach and I love the ocean and we're living under the boardwalk in Atlantic City. And for a few days, I have to say it was pretty amazing. Like we were getting wasted. There was a whole team of us that would like panhandle. And every time I got to tell you coming down here and I get off, you know, 95 and I see those homeless people and I have a soft spot for them because that could be me like that. And that was me like that. And I don't want to ever forget with my 9+ years sober that there's no difference between me and that person begging for change on the corner. And that's God's grace that keeps me here. That's it. It's not anything that I do. You know, he doesn't get me sober because I'm his favorite and I'm special. No, there's work for me to do here. And it's to help the next sick and suffering alcoholic walking through the doors who doesn't know that you don't have to live with the obsession of the mind. There's a way out of this thing. So, yeah, I go and, you know, things are getting bad. And I just remember, you know, getting into this state-run psychiatric facility. And God puts angels in our lives. You know, he does. He lines everything up perfectly for us. Just the way the program comes together comes my journey into Alcoholics Anonymous. And after being homeless and doing all that stuff, and that sucked, I kind of welcomed the chance at going into the state-run psychiatric ward. And there's really crazy people in there, you know, crazy things are happening in this place. And they're like really, like I was kind of like fake crazy. I was really just an alcoholic. I learned that later on. These people were like actually crazy. And I was scared, you know, and I would journal and I would write. And I still have that journal, which is always a fun read when I'm feeling sorry for myself. Read the journal that you wrote when you were on Thorazine. Yeah, read that one. Yeah. That'll bring me back to gratitude real quick. And it does. So I'm in the psych ward and I fall in love with another guy, Tyrone. I remember his name very well. And, because, you know, he becomes a kind of a big part of my story later on. Well, not big, but you know, enough so that I remember his name and we fall in love and everything is great. And I'm in there for a little bit and I dry out from the alcohol and I start getting this restlessness, irritability and discontentedness back again, like we talk about in the doc. And I need something for that. You know, I don't have a solution for that. I'm crawling out of my skin and I can't drink and I want to drink, but I know I can't cause I'm on lockdown. And these crazy people were getting like actual drugs, like narcotic drugs. And we don't talk about drugs and alcohol, even though Bill talks about it in a story. He talks about sedatives, but we don't talk about it out of respect for the Sacred Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there wasn't alcohol available in the psych ward, so you could guess what I was scheming my way for. And I started acting like I was actually crazy. And I would go up to these patients and they were, you know, war vets and they were getting good stuff. And I would like convince them that I was a character from the Bible and they should give me their meds. And I was like running game on them. And they did. And this became my new racket. And there was this alcohol and drug counselor who was like watching me from a corner. And she sees this going, she sees me waiting in the med line one day and like talking to this guy that was in a wheelchair who had PTSD and like running game on him basically. And she does this and I go over to her and I don't remember her name, but she was an angel in my life. And I don't remember exactly what she said either, but she said something to the effect of, you know, you might benefit from going to an alcohol and drug rehab. And my next question was, well, can you smoke in there? Because you couldn't smoke in the state-run psychiatric. And she said, well, yeah, but I really, you know, and then her next question was, do you have insurance? And I said, no, I do not. And she said, well, lucky for you, it's state-run, but you've got to be a really bad case because they only have two beds open for people that don't have any money. And she said, do you think that you're an alcoholic? And I didn't know, I mean, I just knew I'd be able to smoke cigarettes and the food wasn't going to be state-run food, so that's really all I cared about. And I said, of course I'm an alcoholic. Yes, that sounds good. Let's get me out of this place, you know. And I have no desire to get sober. Despite the evidence of my past, I still think I can control it because I am powerless when it comes to this thing called alcohol. And I'm powerless over the obsession of the mind returning, you know, as evidenced, you know, from who I am. And so I go to the rehab, and I stay in touch with Tyrone. I got my one phone call a week. And I just remember this guy, Willie. You know, Willie was awesome. And he was like an old-timer in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I remember he used to walk into the mess hall where we would eat, and he would be like, you know, if you want what we have, you got to give it away. And he would spell, you know, turn your thinking upside down. And he would say all the slogans that we hear in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was like, these people are crazy. Like, what are they even? This is nuts. And my big book, I still have it today, came right from the bed of the woman that was there before me, who I don't think made it. And that big book is falling apart now because of, you know, how many times I've taken women through the work. And it's sacred to me, and I don't let it leave my room, you know, well, except when I go out in the living room to do step work. And that's where I got it. I got it from this rehab. And I only went to one rehab, you know. I'm not a one white ship wonder by any means. I had 3 years hard time with this deal. But, you know, I read my big book and I try to memorize it because I want to prove that I'm smart and I want to prove that I can graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous and let me live, you know, let my people go, let me out of this 28-day program, and I want to get back into my mom's house. And I have all these resentments, you know, towards my family because, again, I need an address. I'm a warden of the state at this point. So my mother held the key to my future. If she would have just said, Allie can come home, they would have let me out of the psych ward, but she didn't do that. We'll talk about that on step four. I had a huge resentment against her for that. How dare she? And anyway, so I get out of the rehab and I get released and I get driven in a state car with, you know, the glass panel up because I was still in danger, a danger to myself and society, I guess, whatever. And I get sentenced to this halfway house, but up there they're called Oxford houses. They're actually three-quarter way houses, which I always thought was hilarious. Like, you know, just call it what it is. Like, we don't have complete freedom and we're not complete in society. It's still a halfway house. Like, why are we calling it an Oxford house? I don't know. But anyway, that's me thinking I know better. And so I get to this Oxford house, and it's all women, and none of them are working a program. Everybody's stark raving sober, and a lot of the girls are going to NA, and I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. I knew that when I put other substances, you know, for some reason, and this is how demonic the disease is for me, for some reason I could admit that I had a problem with the other stuff. I knew I did, but when it came to alcohol, I had this curious sensation that it would be different this time. Chapter 3, I'm Jim, I'm the jaywalker, I'm Fred, I'm a man of 30, I'm all these people that Bill writes about in the big book. You know, when I read it in black and white, I'm like, holy crap, like he wrote a book about me. That's insane. How did this old guy in the 30s write this book about me? Like, what? That's crazy. And who am I to argue with that, you know, when I sit down and I'm surrendered? So I'm in this Oxford house, and I remember 27 days going by, and I had this woman that I had been calling for help. You know, I didn't have a sponsor. And I just remember sitting there and I was writing and I was listening to my emo music and feeling sorry for myself because that's what I like to do back then. And all the old thoughts come back. You know, I'm ahead of my, you know, this is the ego lying to me. All the lies get me out of self. I need a solution. And all of the ickiness, you know, I'm an alcoholic. I have alcoholism, which means when I put alcohol down, that's when I really become an alcoholic. Not before. Before, I'm anesthetized. I'm numbing myself. But when I put the alcohol down and I don't have a solution yet for my thinking, I don't have a solution yet for the internal condition, that's when I get really crazy. I don't have, you know, I need something bigger than myself that's going to restore that. And I have to be willing to sacrifice to get it. And that's what that first step is asking me to do. So I'm journaling and I'm listening to my emo music. I think it was The Cure or something crazy. And I start thinking, you know, I want to write the next best novel and I need substances to do that because all my favorite writers had substances when they did that. And I start aligning myself with these guys again. And here comes the recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. And it's on me. That disease is on me. And the obsession of the mind sounds something like this. Yeah, you know I had a DUI, and I was in the psych wards, and I was swimming up, you know, Craps Creek, and all that, and I get kicked out of college twice, and I'm homeless by choice, and all this stuff, but this time I'll just drink beer. And this is the obsession of the mind. This is what we talk about in this first step. And I remember calling my friend and saying to her, I just need to get out. Like, I just need to get outside of myself. I can't take this anymore because I didn't have a solution. And she tried to talk me off the ledge, but the relapse happens before I pick up the drink. I already made up my mind I was going to go drink. So I called Tyrone. And I was like, hey, Ty. I was like, you know, what's going on? Because, you know, I had gotten released from the psych ward, and then I tried to stay in touch with him. And I get a hold of him, and back then it was on a payphone, and I happen to have his number because we were going to get married. So, of course, I had his number. And And I call him, and he tells me that he's like living in an efficiency right down the road in the next town over. And he comes and picks me up, and we go to the bar. And it wasn't even a thought in my mind. It was absolutely, I will drink. And I order a drink, and that's it. And then he winds up being a dealer of sorts, which again, I'm like, oh, thank you, God. Like, finally, something that's going to really help me get outside of myself. And that doesn't end for me. You know, I proceed to hit a bottom that I never knew was possible with Tyrone. You know, I'm living with him. We're on the side of the road, Route 9, you know, South Jersey, right outside of Atlantic City. And I don't draw a sober breath. And I am pretty, you know, I'm 40 pounds thinner than what I am right now. Tyrone winds up getting locked up because he violates probation. And I try to take over the family business. And, he, you know, his brothers are living in Georgia or Tennessee, somewhere down south. And they, you know, they know that I'm partaking in, you know, his business. And they don't trust me with it. So they come up from Georgia. And I had already been stealing from Tyrone. So they were, like, after me. And now my life is in danger. And I think this is how God got to me. You know, because that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to talk about how it is that we came to establish a relationship with God that's going to enable us to solve all of our problems. That's what we're supposed to do from the podium. Like, I try to talk about the drunkalogue on step one, but it's hard for me not to, like, it's hard for me to ignore this power that saved my life. And so this is how it starts working for me. And this is how this power starts to come and get my attention. And I called my mom one day. And I come to, and I just can't do it anymore. You know, Bill says he's scared that he's going to cross the street, you know, lest he collapse and be run down by an early morning truck. And I relate to that. I had no strength in me. I couldn't do it. I couldn't stop starting. I wanted to stop. And I could stop for a little bit, but I couldn't stop starting again. And I was out of money, and the brothers were coming up from Georgia, and they were after me. I hadn't talked to my mom in a long time. You know, she didn't know what was going on with me. And I call her from a payphone, and for the first time, I admit that I think I'm an alcoholic, mom. And she's like, well, what do you want to do about it? And here's how God works in my life. You know, way back in that rehab, I had fallen in love with another guy. Also, great forearms, you know, and probably was missing a few teeth. I don't know why I had this thing for forearms, but whatever. That was like as far as my standards went back then. And I watched this guy detox off of heroin, you know, I saw him. And he had come down to the halfway house in Boca Raton called Boca House. Wow. Boca House. And they had a sister counterpart called Awakenings. And at this point, I only have a trash bag of things to my name. That's all I have, right? And in this trash bag, I had a brochure somehow for this place called Awakenings. And it had survived all the drinking and the other stuff I had done. And it's wrinkled because it had gotten wet a bunch of times. And I pulled it out, and it was like, I knew that that's where God wanted me to go. And I had a moment of clarity where I get shifted. And I admit to my mom that I think I'm an alcoholic. And she was relieved. And she said, well, what do you want to do about it? And I said, well, there's this halfway house down in Florida. And I remember her being like, what? Like, what do you, like, we're from New York. Like, what are you talking about? Like, people go to Florida to die. Like, old people go down there. Like, what do you mean? And not only that, but it was, you know, a lot of money for us to get in there. And nobody was going to give me any money because of my track record. With when you give me money, that's it. Like, I'm off to the races. But my grandmother, who I'll talk about a lot more later on, you know, she gets up, she saves my life. And we had a tumultuous relationship. And she gets up, she gives the money for me to come down here because my family is really scared. And they're really worried about me. And here's how selfish and self-centered I am. I think, you know, my drinking is only hurting me. And so I come down to Florida. And, you know, I come to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And it's at the 7 a.m. at the Lions Club in Boca. And I walk in. And I just remember, everybody was so freaking happy. And it's like 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was different. I had tried going to a few meetings, and you know, I went to a few meetings out of the rehab. And this was different, though. I mean, people had some, there was something about people in the rooms down here, right? Bill says Ebby is fresh skinned and glowing, and he makes a demonstration. You know, he's going to use this word demonstration a lot. He gets it from another book. And people demonstrated to me in that meeting. And I wanted what you guys had, like, right away. And I couldn't even describe it. It was almost on a subconscious level, but I sensed it. The God in me sees the God in you. And that's what pervades in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the first word of the first step. We do this thing together. We never do it alone. And that's how my higher power works. To get to me, he's going to get to you so that we can get healed together. And so in my halfway house, you know, there's all these rules. And of course, I have resentments towards the rules. And I hate following rules. And I hate group things. And I didn't want to do the Lord's Prayer because I was, you know, a non-practicing Jewish girl. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm Jewish when I have to do the Lord's Prayer. Like, I was never Jewish growing up. But now all of a sudden I can't get on my knees and I'm Jewish. Like, no. You know, that's the defiance in me. And I see this girl, and she's also Jewish, and she's from New York, and she had these Tory Burch shoes, and she was, like, super petite and, like, designer clothes, and I was like, I'm going to get her to sponsor me because I doubt she's an alcoholic, and I still don't really think I am. Like, I'm not really buying in all the way yet because I still have a problem with this first step. And so I asked her to sponsor me, and, you know, she was really, she had a year sober, which, and then after the first time we met, and she shared with me how she drank, and she got me to share how I drank, and she read the doctor's opinion with me, and she said, you know, I want you to listen to these guys called Joe and Charlie. They helped save my life, and I think they can help you too, because I had a lot of questions. And she probably couldn't answer some of those. So she said, let's just listen to the tapes together. So we start listening to Joe and Charlie, which are these big book guys. And I get really attracted to what these guys have through the audio recordings. And, you know, they start breaking down the steps in a way that I never thought possible. And I learned that it's a very simple program for very complicated people like myself. And, you know, she tells me things like, you have to concede it to your innermost self. This is the first step in recovery and the gift of the surrender. And are you done? And yes, I am. I'm done. I want what you have. And 30 days goes by, and I'm not all in yet because, again, I'm not ready to really surrender. And I want it, but there's still this obsession of the mind that will come back unless I'm fully ready to admit it. And this is just my experience. That's all I can share up here. And that thought comes in, and I'm 30 days sober, and I'm in my halfway house, and I'm doing the deal. And, you know, I'm sharing at meetings. I already have a home group, and I'm already taking a few hostages, a.k.a. sponsees, and I'm trying to take them through the doctor's opinion. And this thought comes in, and it tells me, you know what? It wasn't really that bad. You can go drink this time. Chapter 3. There's directions in there. You don't think you're an alcoholic. Step over to the nearest bar room. So I was like, well, let me find one of these bar rooms down here in South Florida. And I take my big book, and I walk to the bar from the halfway house. I sneak out at night because we had a curfew, and I sneak out. And I had my home group in 2 days, so I knew if I was going to go out and try the experiment, you know, I had to plan it out. And so I go to the bar, and I bring my big book, and I'm sitting there, and I'm reading chapter 3. And it says, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, order a drink and then try to stop and try to stop abruptly. Bartender, I'll have a 20-ounce Stella Artois. Why did I order Stella? Well, it's French. I think it's French. There's fruit in it, so I think it's fancy. Rich people drink it. Maybe I'm not going to get drunk from this one. It'll be different this time. The great obsession is the idea that somehow, someday, I'm going to be able to control and enjoy my drinking. Right? And that's the key, is enjoying it. Right? I maybe could have controlled it a little bit. But enjoying it. No. Not the way I drink. I drink pop-off vodka straight from the bottle. That's me enjoying it. So I'm sitting there with my big book, and I'm all by myself because I don't like to drink with people. They just get in the way of me getting drunk. And I, you know, I'm on a mission. So I'm drinking by myself because, you know, that's what I want to do. And these guys are like staring at me. Again, I'm in the rehab capital of the world. It's probably not the first time they've seen a big book, a nice big blue book in a bar. But they're looking at me like I'm crazy. And I order those two 20-ounce beers, and I'm so afraid of being an alcoholic at this point that I have to concede, I have to prove myself an exception to the rule, and I force myself to leave the bar. And I don't want to do it, but I don't want to be an alcoholic either because I still need alcohol to work for me. I haven't yet surrendered. And then this is what I do because I am an actress who wants to run the show and I want to play a part because I need you guys to like me. I need you guys to love me and I want to be a good AA. So of course I'm not going to tell anybody that I tried this experiment and I start picking up chips in Alcoholics Anonymous and I start stealing time from the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. The sacred ground, the sacred fellowship where we have this higher power that has saved all of us right here, right now, tonight. And I'm stealing from it because I don't know of any other way. Selfish and self-centered to the extreme. That we think is the root of my problem. That's the root of my problem. Not the alcohol. Alcohol is but a symptom. We don't talk about it after page 45. But the selfishness is that's why I'm going to continue to put this stuff in me. The very stuff that's killing me. And I'm going to continue to repeat it. And I don't know that there's another way. And I'm coming into the rooms and God is patient with me. And I just call my higher power God. You don't have to call it that. That's just works for me. Again, I'm just sharing my experience. And And I go and do this thing called the fifth step, and the principle behind that one is integrity. And then they say things. You know, Bill gives us a lot of warnings. He's like, anything you keep off your fifth step, you're going to drink over. And I was like, no, I won't. And then, of course, 30 days after lying on my fifth step, I go, try it again. And this is how, you know, my 3 years, this is how I would get some time, right? And then that great obsession of every, I'm the abnormal one. I keep thinking I'm the normal one. The great obsession of every abnormal drinker is the idea that I'm going to be able to keep doing it, or it's going to be different, or I'm just going to do this, and I'm not going to tell anybody. And then I have an even bigger lie that tells me I'm not even really an alcoholic. None of that stuff even happened. I have to block. I can't get honest. I can't drink on the truth. I have to drink on a lie. If I get true, if I get honest about the fact of all that stuff that's happened, it would be crazy for me to put alcohol in my system at that point. And that's why he calls us crazy. Bill calls us crazy a lot in the big book. And I love working with women because I tell them that, like, by the way, don't get offended, and if you do, welcome. But Bill's going to call you crazy a bunch of times in the first four chapters. He spends four chapters, plus the doctor's opinion, plus a couple forwards, just getting me crystal clear about the first two steps. That's it. We have to be convinced. I had to be convinced. And what happens for me is that the pain gets so great, I'm wearing a mask in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'm saying one thing in the rooms, and I'm going home with the disease at night, and I want to kill myself in a way I never wanted to before I came into the doors of AA. And that's a dangerous place. You know, Bill writes a story, The Boy Whistling in the Dark. He wants sobriety so bad, but inwardly he feels he doesn't deserve it. That was me for 3 years, and it's a wonder. It's a miracle I didn't blow my brains out living with that kind of diseased thinking and that soul sickness that I had. It's a miracle. And I wasn't suicidal when I was drinking. I was too drunk for that. I drank those thoughts away. But not drinking is a whole different deal for me when I don't have a solution. So I try to prove that I'm an exception to the rule. And I don't surrender by myself. I have to surrender with the group. That's how it works. The we part of the program. We had to first admit it. You know, he says we're 100 men and women who have recovered. He keeps using this word we. Why? Because I think I can do it by myself. And Bill's going to pound it into my head. No, you need the group. You need us. This is how we get well. This is how we save each other. I don't get spiritually fit praying and meditating by myself in an ashram. I wish I could. I need somebody to bounce the stuff. I need somebody to give it away to, just like Willie's told me in the rehab. You know, and so I was sitting there and I remember this is what finally happens for me, and it's grace. And there's no other way to describe it. You know, I can't restore myself to sanity. I can't remove the obsession to drink. I'm always going to have the allergy, by the way. I am recovered. I'm a recovered alcoholic one day at a time, spiritually fit, because I no longer suffer from the insane notion that I can put it in my body and I'm going to be okay. I've recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, but I'll always have the allergy. And so things get really bad for me, and this disease gets bad, and it's running me. And I go out, and I decide to get a bottle of something I never drank before, and I think it was raspberry brandy, or is that a thing? I don't know, blackberry something fruity. Because, again, I'm a vodka girl, so I just said, let me get something fruity. Somehow I always thought that if I had fruit with it, it was going to be okay. And that's that. Now I'm not an alcoholic because I have fruit. Whatever. And I'm living with my sober roommate, and I had tried to surrender earlier that week. You know, I was doing the third step prayer on the beach in Del Rey, drinking a Natty Ice, which is a very cheap strong beer, which also doesn't work. You know, don't try to do the prayers or the steps if you're still drinking. Disaster. Does not work. We don't recommend that. I don't recommend it, even though I tried it. And so I told my sober roommate that the reason why I was, you know, isolated in my room is because I think my bipolar came back. This is what I tell her. I said, I think I'm depressed again. And, you know, I made up a lie that I was going to see a psychiatrist and they put me back on meds. And I just had to lock myself in my room until the meds kicked in because I was like bipolar again. And the truth is that I had been drinking and lying about it and I was too ashamed to face her. And I had sponsees at the time. You know, I was doing service, but I wasn't doing it from a place of love and purity and honesty and all that stuff on back there on that banner. I wasn't doing it from a surrendered spirit. I was doing it from ego. I was doing it from selfishness. I was doing it from fear. You can't do that. I can't live clean and be dirty. It doesn't work like that. Old self must die. I had to surrender and sacrifice and give up my old ways. So I asked God for help because that's the only thing that I'm taught to do. You know, I love in the rooms when they say, oh, if you don't want to drink, just, you know, play the tape all the way through. Yeah, that's going to work. Let me use the same mind that tells me I don't have a problem. Where are the diseases? To use that mind to play that tape through. Or what are my other favorite? Oh, just sit on your hands. Excuse me? Do you know what I used to do to drink? Are you insane? Like, that's going to work. The only thing that works for a chronic alcoholic, if you have the obsession of the mind, and this is what's true for me, is prayer and how I'm going to relate myself to God. That, you know, the sacrifice, the intention has to come from within. A cry in the dark. And that's what it was for me. So I'm sitting there with my bottle, and I'm trying, and I'm doing an experiment on myself again, because I love to do those, because I have a scientific mind. And I'm sitting there with my journal, and I'm like, okay, the book says that I have an obsession of mine. Check. I knew I had that, because I couldn't stop thinking about drinking that whole week. Like, it was just running me. And I'm lying and pretending to be sober, but meanwhile, I'm like, when can I drink? When can I drink? When can I drink? And so I get my bottle, and I'm sitting there with my journal, and I'm like, all right, so if I have this disease, I should be able to put it in my body, and then I drink it. And I take a swig of it, and I'm like waiting for this magical, you know, allergy to kick in. And I'm like, do I feel anything? Like, is there a stirring in my belly? Like, what's going on? And I was insane. I was psychotic when it came to this stuff. And all of a sudden it hits my stomach and I feel that relief and the beast wakes up. We all have a sleeping beast inside of us as an alcoholic. I mean, I do. And the beast wakes up and roar, and I want more. And I just dumped that bottle back. And right then and there, I knew beyond a shadow of a doubt, I was an alcoholic. I finally conceded it to my innermost self. And I think God just came in there and rescued me right at that moment, because he knew I was doing this crazy experiment, you know. And he probably also knew that I was going to die if I kept going this way. I was going to take my life. He knew that. You know, he knows way more about me than I do. And so I just remember at that point, you know, the alcohol wearing off. And at some point, I was sitting there, and my prayer went from, dear God, please don't make me get honest, to, dear God, please help me get honest. And that little shift, that little help is what separates me from suffering from the delusion that I can still drink. And that is God's grace. I was finally ready to surrender. That little help doesn't come from me. Not for somebody as sick and suffering as I am. I am doomed to die. Step one, we get bad news. To be doomed to an alcoholic death, step one, or to live life by spiritual principles, steps 2 through 12, are not always easy alternatives to face. Really? Because if you're an alcoholic like me, that should not be a hard decision to make. But if you have the obsession of the mind, that's going to be a very difficult decision to make, because you're still in the insanity. I was still in the insanity. From there, I surrender to this thing. And everything shifts for me. And this is just how it works for me. When I finally said, help me get honest, it was like a whole world came into view. Scales of prejudice fell from my eyes. And I reached out. And from there, everything became about him. So that's what I have on step one. Next week, we'll talk more about what that's like. Thank you. Do you unmic me or go down there?
Thank you, Allie. Now the secretary's report.
You hear me? Cool. We're good. In keeping with the seventh tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going to go around. While they're doing that, I've asked Shay to come up here and read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what exactly it means to be a recovered alcoholic. So here's Shay.
Hi, I'm Shay. I'm an alcoholic. Hey. Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered but not cured? That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. But we have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of alcoholic centers in his mind rather than his body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
Thank you, Shay. 1940s Big Book style sponsorship from the forward of the second edition of Alcoholics Anonymous. The alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% of them got sober at once and remained that way. 25% of them sobered up after some relapses. And among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, come to believe, and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I please see a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? More importantly, does anyone in the room need a sponsor tonight? A big book sponsor? No one? Okay. Well, if you do, just see one of the folks with their hands raised, and they will be happy to take care of you. Couple quick announcements. We have some volunteer opportunities. Most of that information is going to be on the back. If not, you can go to Intergroup, and they will be happy to provide more information. You need medallions, big books, AA literature. Intergroup is your place. Broward County Institutions Committee, where's our girl? Is she here tonight? Would you stand up, please? 1 second. What's your name?
Alex.
If anyone wants more information on the Broward County Institutions Committee, please see Alex after the meeting. Their next meeting is April 13th, so it's coming up in about a week. So, Sunlight of the Spirit, this weekend, actually. So there's going to be a general service assembly. If you guys are interested in like seeing how this kind of stuff works, how these assemblies, how these conferences work, this weekend you could check out and you could see how it all comes together. Any 12-step housers in the room? There's an old-timers meeting Saturday night. Saturday, May 4th? Well, it's every week, but May, yeah. May, there's going to be free coffee and free stuff, and there's an event going on there. So, in case anyone's interested. Victory Picnic. It's the annual Victory Picnic at Snyder Park in Fort Lauderdale. A lot of fellowship, a lot of food, a lot of fun. Mickey and Marie are going to be flying in from Colorado for Fellowship of the Spirit, June 21st and 22nd. Fourth annual Chapters to Recovery. More information in the back. It's pretty brief right here. June 28th to 23rd. If anyone happens to be in the state of New Jersey this fall, checking out the foliage, There's a AA convention going on. There's a bunch of speakers, and there's more information in the back. And then that's us. Thursday night, we are here every Thursday night. Please also join us on Monday nights, the Big Book Study Meeting, where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship starts at 6:30. Our study starts at 7:15. It's on the third floor of this building. We also have CDs, mugs, large print Big Books, Little Red Books, and Big Book Dictionaries for sale. Again, we'll be here next Thursday, starting promptly at 7:15. We ask that you be courteous and ready to be in at the sound of the bells. Allie will be here again next week and several weeks to follow. One last quick reminder, no smoking, no vaping, 75 feet from the building. There's scouts here tonight. Just please hide yourself over in the corner. And that's it. We'll see you next week.
We have tonight's sessions and all the past speaker podcasts online at freealcoholicsandgod.org. I would like to invite everyone to our Monday night Big Book study. And to the people that wish to thank the speaker, please line up down the center aisle. Let's close with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father,
who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil.
I am desperately in need of restoration.
concern. These possessions that I have amount to nothing at all. And I am willing to hand over every one of them. 'Cause they won't profit me anything in the end. On my own, I just can't get it right. It doesn't matter how hard I try, but with you I become a much stronger man. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet again. Getting on my knees puts me back on my feet.
is the light of mine. I'm gonna let it shine, let it shine, 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 let it shine.
Michael Chase, here's that song you've been asking me for a million years. I finally pulled it out the corners of my mind, and here you go. Fog is lifted, see the light, count my blessings when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Fear has left me and I'm standing tall. A pile of bricks now lies where once there stood a wall that I hid behind. For all this time, sometimes it takes a burning bush or a great white light to set you right. Well, my eyes don't cry now, and I'm out to dry. Pity party's over, the guest of honor has arrived, and he's on my side. For the first time in my life, are green now, growing vines. They twist and turn each way, flowers blooming all the time. Right outside my door, but never before I had to change everything to realize that today is the best day of my life. Broken man, I traveled far and wide, drew the great divide through his own heart, yeah. Well, I have a life today when it give away, and it's just about to start. So I face each day, brand new way, show up and plug in my guitar. And I play my songs, and people sing along, and stomp their feet and raise their arms. And here in this moment that we share, nothing could compare. Lessons when I go to sleep at night, and I dream now. Yeah, I dream now, and everything's alright.
Oh man, going on 10 years old that song is. God bless. I love you, Mike Chase. Bye.